A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, you join Catherine Whittaker and myself, David Law, down in a pub basement, a proper pub, where I'm on my second beer. This could all go wrong, folks. Catherine tells me that this is a pub that is used for Dungeons and Dragons conferences.
I don't know what the official word for a grouping of Dungeons and Dragons participants is.
Okay.
I say this with no judgment at all. They look like they're having a whale of a time.
Yeah.
But we are sat in the seats of people that agglomerate in the basement of this pub, I believe every Tuesday, so they could descend on us any moment now.
Yeah, because it's Tuesday.
To play Dungeons and Dragons.
Right, okay, well, I can't wait.
It's a thing.
Okay. It's a beautiful pub. It's a bit spit and sawdust, but, you know, we're here. We've got our beers. Catherine looks offended by that description. It's Catherine's local, and we're here to talk about tennis, folks. Catherine has got the tennis from Madrid on her phone, live as we speak. We'll try not to give you too many live updates of things you already know the result for, but we've got loads of that to talk about. We've got all the results from Barcelona last week, Estoril, not Barcelona last week, Barcelona 2 weeks ago, we had that, Estoril last week, Munich, Rabat as well, and then Madrid this week.
Prague,
yeah, so much going on. All in the build-up to the French Open, of course, which is a few weeks away. We also want to cover off Janko Tipsarevic's interview that we haven't had a chance to talk to Catherine about. We'll do that a little bit later. And first of all, though, we're going to talk about the loose ends, really, the aftermath of last week's podcast to do with Justin Gimelstob, which I think we made our thoughts pretty clear about. But a lot has happened since then, because 2 days later, Justin Gimelstob did indeed stand down from his position on the ATP board after much anger from us and encouragement for him to not be in that position anymore. And many more people as well felt the same. And indeed he did. He put out a long, long statement in the end saying he was resigning from his position. Later on in that evening, he also stood down from his position at Tennis Channel, led to believe that he would probably have been pushed from both positions had he not opted to stand down. But ultimately, the right decision, I would say, a long time overdue, but got there in the end. He apparently had flown to Madrid because he said, "I wanted to look Novak Djokovic in the eye, who's the head of the player council, and the two most important things I wanted to say were first, thank you, and second, to apologise." That in a Chris Clary article in the New York Times. We now have a situation where his position on the board is going to be elected, and 15 names have currently put themselves forward to be on the preliminary list for the player counts, for the player board, and will be chosen. And those people putting themselves forward are people like Brad Gilbert and Tim Mayotte, who we mentioned last week, Mark Knowles, Weller Evans, who was for a long time head of player services, certainly when I joined the ATP back 20 years ago, and Danny Valverde is another one, who's the coach of Grigor Dimitrov and formerly part of Team Murray.
Looking for work elsewhere, coach of Grigor Dimitrov.
Which, I mean, you can put them together, as we know. But he's having a tough old time with Grigor because Grigor's not winning many matches at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, am I going to talk about Grigor Dimitrov or Justin Gimelstob?
Well, Grigor lost 7-6, 7-6 yesterday, so that's the end of that chat.
To Taylor Fritz.
Yeah, who's lost today to Novak Djokovic. But the aftermath is interesting as well, because Stan Wawrinka then wrote a very long letter to the Times newspaper in which he was incredibly critical of the state of governance within the men's game, the board side of things, and really feels as though the players were put in an impossible position that they shouldn't have been in, having Justin Gimelstob in position after all that had gone before. Clearly very disappointed that he wasn't removed from position when important decisions were being made, particularly about Chris Kermode most recently, him not having his contract renewed at the end of the year. Subsequent to that, Roger Federer, Novak Djokovic, and today Rafael Nadal have all been to into their press conferences. Federer was asked about the situation, and he said, "I think it's definitely the right move by Justin to step down. He needs to go back and figure things out. There's no doubt about that. The tour needs to keep moving forward in these challenging times and important times right now. I'm not going to come out." And he was asked, "Why have you not come out and spoken before being asked today in Madrid?" And it was put to him that Stan Wawrinka had done that, obviously on social media and then in his letter to the Times. And Federer said, "I'm not going to come out on social media and all of a sudden comment on stuff. And I was not in, and I've not been in press conferences. If I would have been at an event, you could have asked me, but I was at home. Nobody knocked on my door. Then I would have given my comment." So next time one breaks, guys, let's all get down Roger's house.
It's an invitation to the press to get round his house.
Doorstepping. Yeah. Doorstepping is alive and well. It reminds me of a story Nigel Clark, a journalist who's still on the tennis circuit occasionally these days and was one of the regulars back in the McEnroe years, said they used to just wait with their ears pressed against the hotel doors of John McEnroe to see what they could hear.
So they managed to get up to the floor that he was staying
on. In those days, you know, it's a bit easier.
It's an extraordinary intrusion, isn't it?
So I'm not suggesting everybody should do that to Roger Federer. However, he has basically said, you know, if you want to know what I think, you better come and ask me. So come around my house. Novak Djokovic then yesterday said it was the right decision on Justin's side. It's unfortunate because he's probably been the biggest asset players have had. He needs to go back and deal with that case, find the right state of mind before he tries to come back. Djokovic then said on Chris Kermode, "I think he has the right to be a candidate officially for another mandate. I don't know if he wants to do that or not, but why not? We need as many quality candidates as possible. It will be an important process for us." And then today, I haven't got it down in front of me, but Rafael Nadal was asked about the situation. He was criticised in some quarters for not giving his opinion. We mentioned that last week on the show, that he didn't want to tell the media. He reiterated today, "Look, I have my thoughts. They're the same as they were before. I wanted to say them to the players rather than in the media," which is an interesting one, isn't it? Because Stan Wawrinka has done the absolute complete opposite. He has come out and he has let everybody know exactly what he thinks, and he's actually been critical of those that haven't said anything, and he's said that silence is complicity, which is a damning thing to say. It's very, very strong for a fellow player and a friend in Federer's case to say. And I mean, look, you know, these are guys who haven't said anything, so he's kind of pointing the finger at them and among others.
Yeah, and I believe Stan Wawrinka is right in this circumstance. Silence is complicity. It's perhaps understandable complicity. These guys have a lot of skin in the game, to use an expression that I know Simon Briggs hates with every bone in his body. You know, they've got a lot to lose. They've got a lot at stake. I was moved by Wawrinka's letter, you know, acknowledging so much of the bigger picture stuff about what this episode is indicative of in tennis. I think that's what we need to be looking at now, seizing this opportunity for a clean slate, and not just viewing this as a temporary hiatus by Justin Gimelstob, which is what Djokovic's language seemed to suggest. I mean, he referenced a comeback from Gimelstob to the upper levels of management of tennis sort of in a very par for the course kind of, it's a given way. Now, look, I am a huge believer in rehabilitation. I think there are a fraction of a percent of offenders and bad people in the world that can't be rehabilitated in the right circumstances. And were those circumstances to arise for Justin Gimelstob, I wouldn't just slam the door in his face personally. But however, I see none of them at the moment. I see, 745 words of his statement. Not one of them was sorry. He apologised to Novak Djokovic for standing down from the Players' Council, but he hasn't apologised, he hasn't expressed any kind of apology for what he's done, for the culture that he's created, for any of his actions relating to that crime. I see only equivocation from him, or hear only equivocation from him in relation to that crime. So there needs to be an incredible sea change in the position of Justin Gimelstob for tennis to consider welcoming him back, and for Djokovic to talk about it in that way as if it's a given was quite alarming to me. Federer, I mean, I don't know what I was expecting from Federer and Nadal. I wasn't expecting anything from Nadal after what we had last week of him just kind of shutting it down. From Federer, it was disappointing. It was disappointing. I think what riles me the most is when Federer plays dumb about the power and influence that he has in the sport. I believe that Federer and Nadal together have more power than any other entity or anything combined. And that interview that Simon flew over to Chicago to do with Federer last year at the Laver Cup, they were talking about various different things in tennis. I think it was specifically in relation to the reform of Davis Cup. But Federer said, kind of, I'm going to chat with Nadal and we'll see where we place our chips. We'll see, what we want to move to support. And there was a real acknowledgement there of the power that they have as a unit. There was this sort of feeling, I had this mental image of Federer and Nadal riding in on their, horses like Gandalf on Shadowfax, they have individually they wield an extraordinary amount of power, but together I believe they are aware, particularly Federer, that they have the power to effect immense change in the culture of the sport. So it bothered me that Federer kind of played dumb about that.
Do you not think it is fair enough for those players to say, well, look, I want to do my talking face to face. I don't want to do it through the media. Why should I tell you lot? I'd rather tell the people that can actually affect change directly rather than having a conversation through the media.
Maybe, but did any of what he said suggest that? Maybe.
I tell you what I think.
Maybe, but how powerful was Stan's statement and letter?
It was incredibly powerful. I think there are those that might also say, "Well, okay, you've been very loud and vocal about it. Go and now campaign for the 2020
he might
council and try and actually do something about it yourself, and then you'll be in the firing line."
And he well might. I hope he does.
I think others have pointed out as well that he was on the player council 5 or 6 years ago, and Justin Gimelstob was in position then too. So where does he stand on that? I mean, I would answer that, well, Justin Gimelstob hadn't beaten somebody up at that point. That's one big significant difference. Ultimately, I'm really happy that he stood up and said what he thinks, because I think this is a conversation that needs to be had more generally, so that standards just have to get raised. You can't do things behind closed doors. I also think this particular case needed to be assessed for what it is, and that is unacceptable behaviour, absolutely unacceptable. And I think that the sadness for me is that whilst I understand why Federer, Djokovic, Nadal wouldn't necessarily want to go and just start putting people away in public, none of them made a proper stand in what they said to say, this is not on. We cannot have somebody in power in this game who's behaving like that. We can't. It's It wasn't said. Vasek Pospisil said and it
shows
in
no
that
contrition,
statement. I think it's unfortunate that they didn't see fit to just make that very strong point that you cannot. I don't care how much you might do for raising money for players. We don't want to be represented by people who do things like that.
Yeah, too right.
So that's where we are. That's where we are with that situation. One other thing that Nadal did say as well today was that he'd like to see somebody, a Spanish speaker, on the board who could more represent a lot of players who can't necessarily make their thoughts known as well. Maybe
because it's not just North America; it's the Americas that board position. So not all of those that put their name forward have made their name public. The only one that's public that's a Spanish speaker, I believe, is Dani Valverde. But there could be others.
Yeah, and actually, I think he would be a really interesting choice. Somebody that I've got a lot of time for Dani Valverde, I could definitely see him being effective in a different way. It's like I talked about the different types of leader last week, but we'll see what happens. Should we talk about some tennis?
Let's talk about some tennis.
In this pub in which Dungeons and Dragons get played and talked about. I'll find out what that is later too. So first of all,
it's good old fashioned fun, I think.
Is it?
Well, yeah. It involves computers, but right. Apart from that, it's good.
Okay, well, we're on our own in a little pub, and it's lovely, and I'm on my second beer, so I'm struggling to read the script a little here. But I can see the words Jo Konta, who's had a good run. She reached her first ever clay court final in Rabat last week, and she very nearly won it. She ended up facing Maria Sakkari, who won her, I think it was her first title, wasn't it? It was Maria Sakkari's first title, and it was the first time ever that two Greek players have won tournaments in the same week. Sakkari, who's a heck of a player and seems like a really nice person too, and Stefanos Tsitsipas winning in Estoril basically at the same time.
Yeah, and do you know what it made me think? It made me think, wouldn't it be great if there were a combined men's and women's tournament at which both of these two could play together as a team and we could enjoy that, because they've known one another since they were 6 years old and they've got this glorious relationship. And I thought, they played together at Hopman Cup. That was really good, wasn't it? And then I got sad because that's being done away with.
Although,
and Stefanos Tsitsipas may not be able to play at the ATP Cup because there's no other ranked Greek player.
But the ICF do say that they plan to run the Hopman Cup elsewhere in the calendar. Where that fits, who knows?
Yeah.
But at least that's something.
All those big gaps in the calendar waiting to be filled, yeah.
So how do you look at this, though? The fact that Konta led 6-2, 4-1 in the final and Sakkari ended up winning.
There's a question. Well, I watched her match with Simona Halep this morning as well in Madrid, her second round match. She deserves an enormous amount of credit, Konta, by the way, for flying direct from Rabat to Madrid, and I think less than 24 hours later. And they're both clay, but extremely different conditions in Madrid
at altitude.
Yeah. She beat Alison Risk in straight sets, so I'm very impressed with her for putting in that professional performance against Risk. Comes out a couple of days later this morning to play Simona Halep, and the first few games were an absolute joy. The freedom with which she was swinging, you could see how loose her shoulders were, and loose isn't usually a word you necessarily a descriptor you associate with Jo Konta, certainly not of late. You know, she can be a bundle of anxiety, and then she got into a winning position. I think she was 4-2 up in the first set, and she didn't capitulate or anything. She still continued to play well. But you could see her tense up. She just, the freedom disappeared once she got into that winning position, once she had something to lose.
That's happened a lot the last couple of years. But she's fought through it a number of times in the last couple of weeks, the Fed Cup, and now in Rabat, and obviously first round here. But, I mean, look, clay is a bit of a foreign surface for her. She's never come close to results like she had last week in the past, even when she was at her very best. So You would take from that that there's a lot of reason to be positive for her,
absolutely.
Really, isn't
overall, there? Overall positives. It's just you specifically asked me about her losing from a commanding winning position. I do think that is a concern. But overall, big positives. She certainly looks so much more comfortable moving on clay.
How good can Sakkari be, do we think?
Oh, what an weightlifting. She is. Very good.
She's an unreal athlete, isn't she? She's got coat hangers for
watching
shoulders.
Watching her lift that trophy was amazing. It's like an exercise in muscle flexing. How good can Maria Sakkari be? I feel like I need to ask somebody that knows more about her technique than I do. She seems to have it all to me. Maybe she doesn't have the sort of ease of stroke production, that sort of really natural timing that some have, but that's not a prerequisite for getting at or near the top of tennis.
In time for next week, we're going to text a few people that know stuff about tennis technique.
More about tennis than us.
And then we're going to let you know, right? Maria Sakkari's potential. Munich Munich was won by Christian Garin of Chile. Yeah.
Lots of emergency texts going around our tennis podcast group WhatsApp about the need to learn urgently a lot more about Christian Garin.
Yeah, most of them started by you. It was very funny. Right, Matt, do some research. Who is this guy?
Who is this bloke?
And he was, at the start of 2019, he had won only one ATP main draw victory. That was in 2013. 6 years ago. He was ranked outside the 200, top 200 12 months ago. He loves clay. All 18 of his match wins this season have been on clay. Listen to these people that Christian Garin has beaten. Alexander Zverev, Denis Shapovalov, Felix Auger-Aliassime, Jeremy Chardy, Diego Schwartzman, Pablo Cuevas, who, incidentally, did you see the trick shots? Did you see the shots this guy came up with?
Trick shot specialist.
We'll go on to that in a second. Marco Cecchinato and Jaume Munar. He's beaten all of them on clay this year. He won the 2013 Roland Garros boys title, beating Zverev. And, I mean, he beat Zverev last week, who nearly got him in the end and had match points. But Garin still managed to win. I mean, I think he's a fascinating story. Proper clay courter,
but he's not just somebody that's picking off those that are not relatively comfortable on clay, like your Shapovalovs. He's beating Marco Cecchinato and Sasha Zverev, and there were a couple of other Pablo Cuevas. I mean, you know, he's beating hardened clay courters at their own game. You know, those are rites of passage type victory, those guys, aren't they? I mean I've been on somewhat of a crush Christian Garin course, but I don't, maybe I need to go on more of one.
Well done to him anyway for winning in Munich, and that was his second clay court title of the year. Beat Matteo Berrettini in the final, and Berrettini was going for back-to-back titles in Budapest. So, you know, it's mightily impressive what he's done. Zverev, incidentally, has also been speaking ahead of Madrid. Everything is coming together now. He says everything is starting to be more quiet, and I can now 100% focus on being a tennis player again and not a manager, a lawyer, and five different other things. That takes your time away. Well, which is kind of what we were alluding to last week. He did seem as though he got too much going on in his world, really. Tsitsipas, incidentally, winning that title in Estoril, which, on its own merits, I think it's another one of those steps you have to take along the way to winning big and being a top 10 player. When you're in those tournaments, I remember feeling this when he was in that Next Gen Finals last year. He was the favourite to win it. I felt like he needed to go and win it. And he did win it. And here he's in Estoril. He's the top seed. He needs to win Estoril. And he's gone and won it. I love the fact that he just keeps on backing up the big win against Federer in Australia. And he just comes out. Okay, he's had a couple of ropey weeks here and there, but he's kept on grinding and he's won another one.
Yeah, I think you've made the point very well there. And I loved his celebration as well. It was really big for him. You know, I think his whole family were in the crowd, and he's not thinking, he's not getting too big for his boots, is he, thinking this is a little 250 that I'm not going to be playing next year. It really meant a lot to him winning that title, he just shows a lot of respect for the sport, which is very welcome indeed.
And actually, I mean, even one or two people were saying, oh, you know, his agent got him to write this post on Twitter with all of his thanks to everybody and everybody. But I don't think he did. I think that was Stefanos Tsitsipas thinking, I want to thank everybody I know for what they do for me.
Catherine. Yeah, I mean, his agent has managed other players in the past that haven't done things like that.
No, that's right.
That smacks a lot more of Stefanos Tsitsipas than it does of Patricio Appé, to me. I think it was significant because it has been a bit tough for him since that breakthrough at the Australian Open. Okay, he reached the final in Dubai, but then he had that tough swing in Indian Wells and Miami, and he said, look, I feel like I've played too much tennis. And we talked in Melbourne, didn't we, with Matt, about how concerned we were about his schedule. And he said, I think it was after he lost pretty early in Miami, he said, I just need a bit of a break from tennis, which is alarming to hear from a 20-year-old. But he's obviously had, hopefully, the break he needs. And he's an exciting prospect.
I don't feel like I've seen enough in my life of Pablo Cuevas play tennis. Based on the clips that I saw in that final against Tsitsipas, where he lines up a smash and he ends up hitting a through-the-legs half-volley drop shot instead for a clean winner.
The thing is, though, I'm not sure he used to be this much of a trick shotter. I think
I would pay to watch that alone.
He hit what most people I know in tennis seem to think is the best shot ever in Madrid a couple of years ago. It wasn't on the main court, I don't think. I'm trying to remember who it was against. It was
back to the net, was it?
I don't know how to describe it. He had his back to the shot and he sort of played it behind him. It was all sorts of brilliant. I'm sure it's the first thing that comes up when you put Cuevas into YouTube, but Cuevas trick shot, Cuevas Madrid, whatever. It is mind blowing. It feels like ever since that moment, he's gone, this is my USP, guys. great tennis player, but you know, he fell into that melee of sort of really solid, undistinguished in the best, that in the best possible way, you know, solid clay court guys that do their thing on clay every year. And he's found a way to sort of put his head above the parapet and go, I've got a thing.
I mean,
is my thing.
When you've got somebody who hits a shot like that, I mean, for a start, I've never even seen that shot before. I've never seen a smash fake turning into a half volley through the legs drop shot. Half, you know, I mean, that doesn't exist. I've never even seen Mansell Brahmi hit that one. I've never seen Nick Kyrgios
try that.
Maybe
it's all an audition for the Champions Tour.
I mean, I just watched that and I watched it over and over and over. Every time I just burst out laughing. What are you doing? You can't do that.
Is it better than this, David? I'm playing for the benefit of the tape. I'm playing David. It was against Zverev.
Zverev. Okay. Can I describe it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a drop shot from Zverev. In comes Cuevas. Lob lifted by Zverev. Behind the back passing shot winner from Pablo Cuevas with a little index finger in the air. And that is absurd. Wow.
It's the understated celebration that makes it as well.
Yeah. I mean, that you can't hit that shot. There's been 257,000 views. And he's been lobbed. He's rushing backwards. He sort of paddles the ball underhand behind his back. And he absolutely middles it for a clean winner just an inch over the net. Oh, my God.
It's worth a look,
just
folks.
Keep playing that.
It's worth a look.
For the rest of the podcast. the fact is, though, that he just brings a smile to your face watching him, doesn't he? He is Mr. Cool. And I loved it. But in the end, Tsitsipas won straight sets. That's the other good thing from his perspective. He didn't get drawn into that and end up losing, which you could do. He ended up winning the match. Incidentally, on the subject of trick shots, have you seen Kyrgios's latest? Is an underhand fake, an underarm serve fake, and then a normal serve.
Was this against Struff? Because I didn't like that performance.
Didn't you? I didn't watch any of it. I only watched that clip.
I thought he was a bit sort of disrespectful to Struff.
But Struff won, right?
Yeah, Struff won.
Which is, you know, that's where you come undone.
Exactly.
Is when you lose to somebody
exactly.
You should beat.
And it reminded me of, it was Madrid, I think 3 years ago, when Kyrgios gave me that Guido, when he spat out the words Guido Pella at me. That's this side of Kyrgios I don't like, but hey, I'll still probably be rooting for him in his next tennis match.
Talking of an Australian that you're absolutely unequivocal about, how good is Ash Barty right now?
Ash Barty,
10 wins in a row. What a player she's becoming.
Yeah, I watched her match last night again. I mean, I had a brief nap in the middle, but by and large, I watched
an hour and 50 minutes
last night, folks, against Danielle Collins, which she described as one of the weirdest matches she'd ever played. And, well, I suppose, you know, 6-1, 1-6, 6-1, I suppose, yeah, the scoreline would back that up. But I don't think of her as a clay courter, but that slice, that backhand slice she has really penetrates on the clay in a way that I wasn't quite expecting, and her movement's so good now. I'm not, you know, predicting she'll win the French Open, but I think I perhaps underestimated her a bit on clay.
She's just fantastic to watch. I think she could. She's going to win a slam this year, I think.
This year?
Yeah.
There's only three left.
Yeah.
Which one?
I don't know.
Do you think she'll win Wimbledon?
I don't know. I just said, there's my thing. I've said it. Ash Barty, slam winner this year, folks.
Out of nowhere.
Right, there you are.
Oh, how good would that be for tennis?
Oh, it'd be awesome. She's just so likeable.
Oh, she's great.
Sloane Stephens is being coached by Sven Grunewald, who I think is an excellent appointment. So, I mean, I kind of got that one right then, didn't I, really? Because I said Osaka, but it's, you know, only about 2 months late.
Interchangeable women.
Well, no, but I said he was going to get a big job is what I meant.
Yeah, I think would he take a non-big job, Sven Grunewald?
Well, he took that really talented Chinese player who I can't remember the name of. The young junior champion.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name now.
Yeah.
But that's true. But he didn't stick with him. I'm quite surprised you let me get away with that little, segue into one player statement being the player who would coach, getting it completely wrong.
Well, I haven't. I've gently let you stitch yourself up. It's the best way to do it.
Preferred it when you were just, you know, giving me a good telling off. Right. Kuzmova. He's not here to celebrate, but we're giving her a mention. Why is she on? I mean, listen.
She's done a thing.
No, look, folks. Here's the thing, right? Grand Matt does the agenda. Somehow, Kuzmova's name is on it with an exclamation mark. I mean, she's got no right to be on it.
He's really restrained himself by putting it on page two.
Why is she on it?
Although, I mean,
what's she done?
Well, she beat Yulia Gerges.
Victoria Kuzmova, this is Matt's favourite player, who he predicted would win the Australian Open and lost in round two. That sounds brutal, doesn't it?
No, predicted she'd reach the quarterfinals.
Okay.
I mean, bear in mind, I didn't know what she looked like till last night.
But everybody suddenly started coming out the woodwork.
Yeah,
and saying, oh,
suddenly everyone's like,
Kuzmova.
Oh, Kuzmova. One victory over Carla Suarez Navarro, and everyone's known about Kuzmova for the last 18 months,
yeah,
apparently.
Beaten Gerges as well. So
well,
she
Matt
has
genuinely has been backing her for no apparent reason for the past 4 months.
But actually, she is starting to do stuff. And people were comparing her to really good players. I saw Courtney Nguyen.
Yeah, everyone's suddenly getting... It's all getting out
she's
of hand.
She's the right-handed Petra Kvitova. And she's Anna Ivanovic with, like, you know, muscles and stuff. Oh, dear. It's all happening. Anyway, keep an eye out for Victoria Kuzmova, because we are. We can't get away. And what else has he got on his list here? Nadal's got a stomach bug. He plays Ogier Aliassime next, who beat Shapovalov. We were having frequent texting conversations about that the other day.
Oh, it was feverish, wasn't it? Yeah. The chat about Ogier Aliassime versus Shapovalov.
There's a big row about whether Ogier Aliassime is Djokovic-like. I said he was Djokovic-like. You said...
I said he was more explosive than Djokovic, and you said Djokovic is explosive, and I took issue with that. I think Djokovic is brilliant, but not in an explosive way.
Okay.
I think Ogier Aliassime he's hardened in a way that Shapovalov isn't. He's able to be consistent, and he's a better decision maker already than Shapovalov. But he also has that explosiveness, which I find just an extraordinary prospect. Shapovalov, I'm still on the Shapovalov train. I still want him to succeed, but I am worried that the decision-making chip is missing, and in the history of tennis, that's one of the chips that's hardest to teach. I'm thinking Dimitrov, David.
I'm thinking big coaching assignment.
Yeah, I agree, and I hope that is A, what happens, and B, what makes the difference.
She's hanging,
but
off
I think
the train.
You need to get in there early with that, because the reprogramming, the more baggage you build up, the harder the reprogramming is, and yeah. He needs it, it's the shot selection and decision making on the court is so deeply wired into the hard drive. I know he's still young, and I desperately hope it happens, but I'm just, times are wasting.
I'll coach you, Dennis.
That's the second week in a row Johnny Cash has snuck in.
I believe in you, Dennis. I'm staying on the train.
I'm saying I don't believe.
She's got one foot on the platform, but I'm on the train. I'm still.
I'm driving the train.
Okay.
If you ask me now, who's having the better career, without question, or Gerard Yassim? If you ask me now.
I haven't asked you yet. All right. Well, we'll come back to that in about 4 years when they've grown up. Roger Federer, who is, I mean, imagine that, 4 years' time, Ogier Aliassime is going to be 22. How irritating is that? Roger Federer, who's about 48, is making his clay court return in Madrid, practiced with Dan Evans in Switzerland. I was unavailable, so he went for Dan Evans.
I mean, he was asked about that in his press conference before everyone got into the Gimelstob stuff. He was, I think it was Paul Newman. That's voice identification that's telling me it's Paul Newman from The Independent that asked that question. And I hope, I mean, I guess in anticipation of sort of gushing stuff about Dan Evans, you know, they played at the Australian Open. And Federer just sort of said, oh, he was available.
He wanted a Brummy. I couldn't make it. So, right, there's that. Roger Federer said in his New York Times interview with Chris Clary recently that he is taking a let's see what happens approach. And I must say, that is going to be interesting.
It was a let's see what happens, but it was also, there was some Trump-esque sort of like, oh, something beautiful could happen.
Be careful your comparisons.
Oh, God, is there going to be another petition about me on the internet? Oh, God. You know what I mean, though? It's like, maybe you don't know what I mean. I'm not making eye contact with you. It was like, let's see what happens. Could be something beautiful. Could be something beautiful. If not, it doesn't matter, but really could be something beautiful. I mean, I think he's alleviating the... I think he genuinely doesn't feel any pressure, but I think he's also thinking, I could sneakily win the French Open here.
I mean, I do think he thinks that. I do think he thinks, do you know what? Doesn't matter. I mean, I've won 20 Grand Slams. You know, what do I need this for? I wasn't even going to play clay again, but I'm here, so I'm going to go for it, and you lot deal with me.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, he's been watching every single match that's happened on clay up until this point. You know, he's been watching Nadal not quite firing on all cylinders, and Djokovic the same. And
how far is he going to get the French Open?
Oh, French Open. Oh, we haven't seen him hit a ball on clay yet, David. That is unfair.
All right, okay. I'll give you another week.
You can ask me next week.
Right, okay. Next week.
I'll agree to answer that question.
We'll get a federal prediction next week.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. So, Janko Tipsarevic was a guest here with us on the Tennis Podcast a few weeks ago. He was good enough to spend an hour and 20 minutes in my company on the phone. I've never done an interview quite like it. I found it absolutely fascinating. I didn't agree with a number of things he said, as I said at the time, which is fine. You know, I'm quite happy to hear him out and then take stock. One person that hasn't had a chance to comment on it at all is you, Catherine. So what did you think?
Well, it was a great interview. I mean, he is captivating, isn't he? His fluency in a second language, just aside from what he was actually saying, mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Absolutely mind-blowing. To hold an audience captive in a second language is amazing. And his insights into Djokovic I found really interesting and very worthy of being given a platform, because that was what you asked us on the Tennis Podcast group chat, you know, but just before doing the interview, what do you want to know? And I just thought, I just don't feel like it was exactly as you put to him in your question to him. I just don't feel like we know Novak Djokovic. Tell us what he's like from somebody that knows. So I found that very interesting. I mean, his talk about his own career and mental health struggles and all of that, captivating. I mean, a lot of what he had to say about his views on various other things, in particular gender inequality within sport, I found objectionable. And I think I'm totally happy with him saying them. Plenty of people express views of that ilk, and a lot less eloquently than Janko Tipsarevic did. I just don't want them to sort of sit there unchallenged. Not that you didn't challenge him, you absolutely did, but I think a lot of them don't stand up to scrutiny, really. He seems like an intelligent and thoughtful enough of a guy that he wouldn't mind those views being challenged. Not that I mind whether he did would mind, but
do you want to give some examples so that we know what you're referring to?
Well, I mean, he had two separate justifications for unequal prize money, and when citing each one, he said this is what it's about. It's only about this point. He both cited the fact that women don't play best of three sets and best of five, and started talking about, you know, women sprinters don't run 80 meters while men sprinters run 100, and gave other examples, you know, marathons, etc., etc. But then he also said it's not at all about quality or the nature of the sport. It's entirely about, he said, I'm talking about income generation. It's entirely about income generation, which is that same old market forces argument, isn't it? You know, he said, as an extension to that, the most objectionable and laughable point he made is that we cannot control who and what is generating income in the sport. Now, of course you can. You just have to want to.
How?
Scheduling, for one. I mean, there is an immense inequality in scheduling in the sport. I mean, the inequality pervades the sport at every level. I experience it every day, but it's quite difficult to win arguments against hardened inequality deniers unless you've got hard data. So scheduling is one area that it's very possible to generate hard data. Now, Magic Monday at Wimbledon, the second Monday of Wimbledon every year, it's unique in the tennis calendar in that you get all of the fourth round Grand Slam matches on both the men's and the women's side played on one single day. There is no other day like it in the calendar. It's why we all call it Magic Monday. It's why we as broadcasters, David, every year sell it to our viewers and listeners as the best day in the tennis calendar. Now, other, you know, individuals will have preferences on other days, but that is generally what we accept it and big it up to be. Well, I've looked at the stats on scheduling on the show courts, the matches that are receiving the most eyeballs on them, the most hype, and as a result, the most newspaper coverage the next day, etc., etc. Over the last decade, one third of centre court matches on Magic Monday have been women's, and two thirds have been men's. Not once has there been more than one women's match scheduled on centre court on Magic Monday. On court one, it has been 38% women's to 62% men's. And if anyone says, oh yeah, but that's the last decade, it's been getting better. Well, last year on Magic Monday, there was just one women's match on each of the top three show courts at Wimbledon last year. And I mean, that's just incontrovertible. That's incontrovertible data. And Wimbledon, in defence of that, because they have been asked about it the last couple of years, I got some quotes from Chrissy Evert on this a couple of years ago when it came up, and that, along with other things, prompted Wimbledon to have to give a statement on it. And they basically just shrugged and said, market forces. Well, look, even if you accept the market forces argument, which I find ludicrous, but even if you do, it's the context, it's the nature with which that argument is tossed out. People don't say, okay, look, we're doing this because these are what market forces, to whom we are at the mercy. This is what they dictate. However, we would love it to be different. What can we do to make it not so? Because this isn't right. People just shrug and toss out market forces. You know, Janke Tipsarevic just says, I'm not talking about quality, I'm talking about income generation, and shrug. There's, we cannot control who and what is generating income. It's privilege. It is absolute privilege. It's this just, this is the way things are, and I'm not motivated to change them because it suits me. You might not realise that that's where it's coming from, but for me, that is where it's coming from. It's not right. The markets are sexist, and we do have the power to change that, and we should. And I firmly also believe that it'd be better for men, it'd be better for men's tennis. Equality is great for everyone. It's not, as the argument that Simon Briggs made on our podcast last week about how adversarial the sport feels like it's become, and a lot of people that view the sport as a zero-sum game. And I think that applies to men's versus women, this idea that there is a pie, and any extra bit of the pie that the women want to get via equality is a slice out of the pie that men's has, rather than just, hey, how delicious could this pie be with a bit of equality flavouring in it? Which is how I see it. I mean,
I suppose there's two things from say, use Wimbledon as an example. One is that because it's best of five and best of three on that particular Manic Monday day, you get 2 5-set matches and a 3-set match, which is kind of more for your money. I suppose my argument would be, right, we'll have two of each then.
Yeah.
That'd be fine.
See, right. And their statements never say, hey, we're aware of this. We are at the mercy of market forces, so we have to do it this way. However, we are going to look at how we can sort this out, because it's not right.
Because
there's no will. There's no will to sort it out.
I suppose that because the market forces argument, just to be clear, is that the idea is that more people want to watch, for instance, Roger Federer than they do someone else. But I would say that he is a very extreme example. And Just, I'd look. Ultimately, I do take the same view, which is: do you want it to be different, though? Because if you do, actually, you can. You're part of the problem if you don't schedule it equally. Because women's tennis can't be on the same level in terms of appeal to the markets if it doesn't get the stage as often and isn't as celebrated as much.
Which it isn't. Which it absolutely isn't. I mean, I'm not going to go into all of it, because I'd like to do a special documentary podcast on it. And, you know, I know there are people that tune into this podcast that don't just want to hear Catherine Whittaker going off on one about feminism and equality. But, I mean, all of the stats back up that, you know, UNESCO study in 2018 found that only 4% of sports media content worldwide, and okay, this is all sports, not just tennis. I accept that things are better in tennis than other sports, but that is no reason for complacency. 4% of sports media content worldwide is dedicated to women's sport. Only 12% of sports news is presented by women. There's a stat in Judy Murray's autobiography that I read recently that, according to Women in Sport research, granted back in 2013, but it was government-funded research, only 3% of all sports journalists in the UK are women. Less than 5% of all sports coverage is of women's sport, and just 0.5% of all sponsorship money across all sport goes to women's sport. You are tying women's hands behind their back and saying, shrugging, and saying, oh, you're not winning the egg and spoon race. It's absurd. And I find too often people focus on sort of the idea of individual sexists. And look, there are individual sexists. They're everywhere. But they're not the problem. It's the world and the fact that we live in a patriarchy and the fact that the market forces that we talk about all the time, they are inherently sexist. That's the problem. Mm. And this isn't the natural way of things. This isn't how things should or how we should want them to be. They can be different. Actually, this is just how things have ever been and they self-perpetuate.
And if you go back 12 years, when Wimbledon decided it's time for equal prize money and they brought in equal prize money, they did that because it was the right thing to do. And good for them.
Well, Venus Williams had to write to Parliament to get that to happen.
She was certainly part of that. Well, I don't think it was on its own. But look, they got there, and I would take some heart in that from that.
Yeah, I mean, it's the patriarchy is a distortion. It's a distortion of the markets. It's a distortion of society, and we should be seeking to correct it, and it will be better for everyone. I do understand why men get defensive about it, because it's easy to see it as a zero-sum game and an adversarial thing. That is not how I see it. I could delve deep into the remnants of what I learned from my philosophy degree many years ago, and I didn't take an awful lot from it. But my favourite feminist quote is Gloria Steinem saying, "The truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off." And I feel like we're in a phase of the world and society where an awful lot of people are pissed off and think men are having an awfully bad time of it. But just ride it out because it will set you free in the end. I didn't used to be a feminist. 10 years ago, I was as privileged as they come. I was cocooned in a world of not realizing how things were, totally cocooned. I went to an all-girls grammar school where everyone was completely aspirational and we were encouraged to do whatever we wanted to, and there's no reason to think that anything would ever stand in our way of that. I had incredibly supportive parents who gave me exactly the same opportunities that my brother was given. And I mean, some of the things that I remember saying about equality and feminism, I shudder at now. You know, within the last 10 years, I absolutely shudder at them. And it's been a gradual awakening, via experience and empirical evidence of how things are. And that's privileged. That's privilege. I was privileged. You were privileged. Just open your eyes a bit and don't just shrug off, you know, oh, market forces, that's the way the world is. Because that might be the way the world is, but if it is, then by God, we need to change it.
So go and have a listen to the Janko Tim Savage interview. If you
have I given it a real big up?
If you want to hear the rest of what he had to say, I mean, look, you know, that was a section of it. Catherine, as you can hear, doesn't agree with him. But it's there to be listened to. It's long, it's in detail, and he is fascinating to listen to, whether you agree with him or not. And that's what this show is all about. We hope to produce more interviews of that ilk in the future. We'll be back next week with another show to look back on Madrid, to look ahead to Rome. We'll have hopefully Grad Matt with us, and we'll be back with you again.
The Victoria Kuzmova special.
Yeah, on the Tennis Podcast. Maybe she'll have won it. Maybe she'll have won the whole thing. Brought to you in association with The Telegraph, executive produced by tennisballs.com. And who's our executive producer? It's not Rio with a Y. He is our mascot. Yes, I've definitely had my two beers now. And we'll be back next week. See you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.